This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Bill Nuremberg was an outstanding physicist and an exceptional person. So it's a great honor to get an award in his name. And it's also worth noting, of course, that Bill Nuremberg was also deserves much of the credit for the development of the Scripps Institute as a premier oceanographic institute in the world. And we've had, I should say that in my institute, we had the honor of having Roger Revelle spend a sabbatical, which was about 20 years ago at our institute, which was one of the highlights of our history of our institute. And of course, my research and many others has taken the course that it did because of Dave Keeling and the research that that he started in connection with this institute. So it is a remarkable institute. And there are many scientists here now who are exceptional. And I'm not going to list them, but it is an honor to get this award from Scripps and from Bill Nuremberg. Okay, so now I would like to talk about this problem, which still... It is, you know, we have in global warming all of the ingredients for the perfect storm. One of them being the fact that the carbon dioxide that we put in the atmosphere by burning fossil fuels, a large fraction of it will stay there for a very long time, about a fifth of it staying for of the order of 1,000 years. And we don't see the effect of it immediately because of the inertia of the climate system. The ocean is about 4 kilometers deep. It takes it a long time to change in response to the change in the atmosphere's composition. And it didn't have to turn out this way. There are positive amplifying feedbacks in the climate system, and there are negative feedbacks. But it turns out that our climate system is dominated by positive feedbacks. And once we see that we are creating a problem, it's not going to be easy to change our course because we're addicted to fossil fuels as our source of energy. So it will take decades at least to make major changes. So that's the hard part of the problem. Now, the good part is, the bright side is, that if we do recognize the problem and take actions in the very near future, there are actually many advantages to that. The renewable energies, the fuel itself is free, and we could have a cleaner atmosphere and water, and there would be good jobs associated with relying more on renewable energies. But the status of the matter is there is this gap between what is understood about global warming by the relevant scientific community and what is known about it by the people who need to know, and that's the public and policymakers. The truth is we have reached a point where we have an emergency. And as I mentioned, it's associated with the positive feedbacks and the fact that the climate system can reach tipping points where things begin to happen rapidly and out of our control. And that's the danger. Now, the good news is, and I'm going to argue, and I think convincingly, that we have actually already passed the level of CO2 that we can afford to have in the atmosphere on the long term. We're going to have to roll back the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. And it's still technically feasible, and there are advantages in doing that, but there are special interests who make it very difficult to get this to happen. Part of the problem is that weather fluctuations are so large. The temperature can change by 10 or 20 degrees from one day to another. And even if you average the temperature over a month, as has been done here, the anomalies in the last 4 months, there are some places, some months that it's warmer than normal and some months it's colder than normal, where normal is the 1950 to 1980 average. But if you average the temperature over the first 7 years of this century, you see the patterns become clear, and it's just the nature that we expect for global warming. The warming is larger over land than it is over the ocean because the ocean has thermal inertia and it's only partially responded to the forcing. The warming's larger at high latitudes than low latitudes because of the amplifying feedbacks at high latitudes. As ice and snow melt, the surface is darker and absorbs more sunlight, and that's a positive feedback. And it's larger in the northern hemisphere than in the southern hemisphere, partly because of the larger amount of ocean in the southern hemisphere, and it's particularly small around the Antarctic, where the ocean mixes deeply. The warming in the last century is now about 8-tenths of a degree Celsius, which is about 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit, with 3/4 of that warming coming in the last 30 years. And by the way, we now hear that people say global warming stopped in 1998 because there hasn't been any warming since then. Well, that's just a reflection of the fact that the temperature that year jumped up by 2 standard deviations. That was the strongest El Nino of the century. But in fact, the trend line is continuing to get warmer. Now, with regard to this tipping point phenomena, we need to describe the tipping level, which is the amount of the climate forcing or greenhouse gases that, if it reaches a point such that no additional forcing is required in order to have a large climate change, that's the tipping level. And I will argue that we've already reached some tipping levels. But the climate system requires time to respond. So for example, an ice sheet, you may have enough greenhouse gases in the atmosphere to eventually cause that ice sheet to disintegrate. But it takes time for that to happen. And once it does begin to disintegrate, if the dynamics takes over, then you've reached a point of no return, and it becomes impossible to stop it from going ahead. Here's a case of a phenomenon where I think we have reached, we've passed the tipping point. This is the Arctic sea ice, the area of sea ice in the Arctic at the end of the summer when it's a minimum. If you go back to the late 1970s, there was about 8 million square kilometers of sea ice at the end of the summer. It fluctuates from year to year, but it's been decreasing. And last summer, it decreased to just over 4 million square kilometers. Well, there's more warming in the pipeline because the planet is now out of energy balance by something between 0.5 watt and 1 watt per meter squared. So we're going to get additional warming, and we're going to lose all of the Arctic sea ice in the summer. But this is a reversible phenomenon, in the sense that we can estimate what would be required to stop the Arctic sea ice from melting further. To first order, you'd probably need to restore the planet's energy balance, and that would mean, other things being equal, that you would need to reduce CO2 from its present 385 parts per million to something like 325 to 350 ppm. Which is a tall order, but it's but it's possible. Now, another problem is the sea level and the stability of the ice sheets. Greenland, for example, the area on Greenland that melts, that has surface melt in the summer, fluctuates from year to year. But it has been increasing over the period of satellite data, which began in the late 1970s. And last summer, in 2007, the area with summer melt was the largest in this period of record. One of the reasons that this is important is that the surface melt does not, in general, get to the edge of the ice sheet and go off into the ocean. It finds a low spot on the ice sheet and burrows a hole to the base of the ice sheet, and it contributes to the lubricating the base of the ice sheet and increasing the rate of flux of giant icebergs to the ocean. It's just one of the positive feedbacks that occurs in the disintegration of ice sheets. But these large ice streams have doubled in the flux, in their velocity, in the last 10 to 15 years. And it was unclear until we got this really remarkable data from the gravity satellite, which measures the gravitational field of the Earth with such a high precision that you can measure the mass of the Greenland ice sheet and the Antarctic ice sheet. And we had wondered that in the winter, we know the ice sheets will get heavier as the snowfall piles up. And as the planet gets warmer, we expect the amount of snowfall to increase. But in the summer, the increased melting. So you can see that this seasonal cycle in the mass of the Greenland ice sheet. But there is a downward trend in the mass of the ice sheet. It's losing more than 100 cubic kilometers of ice per year. Last year, it lost about 250 cubic kilometers of ice. So it's consistent with the common sense expectation that as the planet gets warmer, ice is going to melt. And that has been changing fairly rapidly, because if we go back to early 1990s, it looked like Greenland was, though our methods of estimating the mass balance earlier are not as good, but it looked like it was not far from mass balance. But now the trend has been toward losing mass faster and faster. So if we wanted to estimate, well, how would we need to change carbon dioxide if we wanted the ice sheets to be stable? Well, that's hard to say, but there were prior interglacial periods when ice sheets were stable and comparable in size, and CO2, though, was not more than about 300 parts per million. And we know just from looking at what's happening currently that 385 ppm is clearly not going to be stable. It will eventually lose a lot of mass if we keep the CO2 that high. Another criterion for estimating what is the target CO2 that we should be aiming for is to the shifting of climate zones. As global warming increases, the width of the overturning circulation, the rising motions in the tropics and the subsiding motions in the subtropics, That circulation cell expands, and we observe that it has expanded about 4 degrees of latitude on the average in the last several decades. And that is beginning to affect the southern United States, the Mediterranean region, Australia, and South Africa, and is one of the reasons that for the increased dryness in the areas bordering on the subtropics. And so Lake Mead and Lake Powell are now only about half full. Again, I would argue that suggests that we really need to push CO2 backward if we want to alleviate that situation. And perhaps even more important, the mountain glaciers all around the world are retreating. And there are hundreds of millions of people who depend upon fresh water from rivers that originate at glaciers. And once, as those glaciers are melting, you actually get some extra water. But once those glaciers are gone, then you will still get large freshwater fluxes in the spring as the snows melt. But then the summer and fall, the rivers may begin to be more like a trickle. And that's can affect, especially China and India, Asia, those rivers that begin in the Himalayas, but also in the Rocky Mountains and the Andes. And then there's also ocean acidification. The coral reefs are sort of the rainforests of the ocean. There's a large fraction of the biology in the ocean is associated with coral reefs. But those reefs are under stress, partly because the ocean is becoming more acid and partly because of the increasing temperature around the coral reefs. And again, it argues that we've already passed the target atmospheric carbon dioxide. So there are a number of different reasons for saying that we've already pushed. And, you know, you can afford to have an overshoot of the safe level for a short period of time, depending upon what phenomena you're talking about. As I mentioned, an ice sheet doesn't disintegrate immediately. But you don't want to keep running your engine or running your planet in that danger zone too long. You can't afford to stay in that overshoot zone too long. We don't know. Depends on the phenomenon. But the basic problem comes about because of the long lifetime of atmospheric CO2. So if if we put a pulse of CO2 into the atmosphere by burning fossil fuels, about half of it seems to disappear quite rapidly, within about 25 years or so. But then the rate of decline decreases because, in effect, the CO2 that's taken up by the ocean, which is the major sink, exerts a back pressure on the atmosphere. CO2 can come back out of the ocean. So until the CO2 in the ocean has been taken out and put on the ocean floor as sediments, and that takes thousands of years, you will still have excess CO2 in the atmosphere. After a century, about a third of it is still in the atmosphere, and after 1,000 years, about a fifth of it is still in the atmosphere. The major implication is we cannot burn all of the fossil fuels and put the CO2 into the atmosphere without creating a completely different planet. And if you look at the fossil fuels, it becomes clear there's uncertainty. The fossil fuels that have been burned so far are the dark regions, oil, gas, and coal. And then there's land use. The deforestation has also contributed CO2. But oil, it's uncertain as to how much there is still in the ground. Most people now think we're probably used about half of it. And we're going to use the rest of it. You know, it's owned by OPEC nations and Russia, and you can't prevent them from selling their oil, and it's going to end up in the atmosphere because it comes out of tailpipes and it's not practical to catch it. But the biggest potential source is coal, and that's the one which we could decide either we're not going to use it, we're going to leave it in the ground, or we will burn it at power plants where we can capture the CO2 and sequester it. If we would do that, then depending upon how big these reserves are, CO2 would actually start to decline within the next few decades as oil runs out. If the large estimates for reserves are right, then it would peak at about 425 parts per million. But I think more realistic estimates, and especially if we prevent oil companies from going to places like the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and other public lands and the Arctic and Antarctic, then it's more likely that the peak would be about 400 ppm. We would still have CO2 exceeding the 350 ppm initial target level for at least a couple of centuries. And my suspicion is that that long of an overshoot is dangerous, and things like ice sheets may not survive that long an overshoot. So you may want to, we would like to try to bring it down faster. And there is some potential to do that. Right now, we're doing a very poor job on forestry and agricultural practices, which we could improve so that the forests and the soils would store more carbon. With reforestation and with things like biochar, where you mix charcoal in with the soil to improve the productivity of the soil, you could get CO2 to come down faster and maybe take up as much as about 50 ppm of CO2 out of the atmosphere and get CO2 back to 350 ppm faster. And there are additional things you could do, for example, with power plants that are powered by gas, you could capture the CO2 and sequester that and move it back even faster. So it's technically possible to get back to 350 parts ppm. But that's only true if we phase out coal. I forgot to mention, by the way, that in this scenario, the reason that it peaks is that we're assuming that we will have a moratorium on new coal-fired power plants within the next few years, and we will phase out the existing ones by 2030. That is difficult, but, you know, it's if you compare it to how much effort we put into World War II, it's not that difficult to have either different energy source or you capture the CO2 at the power plant. So that's the critical. The coal is the critical part of this story. The energy departments tell us that they act as if it is a God-given fact that we must burn all of the fossil fuels because they are there. I think that we should have a free will, and and the coal is the main part of the story, but in order to discourage the unconventional fossil fuels like tar shale and things like that, which would add even more CO2, we should really have a carbon price and help us conserve the oil and things until we've developed the energy systems beyond fossil fuels. And we can get about 25 ppm CO2 equivalent by reducing things like methane and black soot. The basic conflict, it seems to me, comes down to one between fossil fuel special interests and young people in nature, young people who will bear the real consequences of the climate change. And it looks like it's an unfair fight between fossil fuel special interests because they have influence worldwide. And young people are not really organized, and they're not even aware, I think, of the issue as much as they should be. And the animals aren't much help. They don't talk and they don't vote. So, as I've said, the one critical action is stopping the construction of more coal plants. And I think that citizens are going to have to make this happen. I don't think Congress will do it without a lot of encouragement. But if we would once start moving in the right direction, then I think we could get positive feedbacks that would make things happen much more rapidly. And we begin to move to the energy systems beyond fossil fuels, which we're going to have to do anyhow at some point. And we have a lot of potential for innovations. So my the challenge is, how can we do this sooner? Why can't we get started now? And you know, actually, we all agreed. Essentially, all the countries in the world signed the Framework Convention on Climate Change more than 15 years ago, with the aim of stabilizing greenhouse gas emissions at a level that would prevent dangerous human-made interference. And I think the two criteria, the two metrics that we should pay most attention to are those which are irreversible, effects that are irreversible on any practical timescale. Ice sheets take tens of thousands of years for an ice sheet to build up from snowfall. So if one or more of them disintegrates, the sea level rise will be, for practical purposes, a permanent disaster. And then there's the extermination of species, which again is a irreversible process. If we had global warming of even 2 to 3 degrees Celsius, that would make it as warm as it was in the Pliocene when sea level was 25 meters higher. There are several hundred million people who would be below sea level with such a sea level change, including essentially all of the people in Bangladesh and a few hundred million in China alone, and of course the east coast of the U.S. and Florida. With regard to species, as the temperature zones move poleward, we're in effect pushing off the planet those species that live at the high latitudes. And likewise, the species that live in the alpine regions, for this specific example is a squirrel that lives on a single mountain in the southwest, which is now the forest there. They've had forest fires in the lower reaches, and as the temperature lines have been moving up, the forests do not regrow where they burned at the lower levels. So, and again, in effect, we push the species off the planet. And so in general, what we're doing with the climate zones and their impact on different species is, given isotherm is now moving poleward at a rate of about 50 to 60 kilometers per decade, and some species can migrate and stay within a climate zone that they're adapted to, but others don't migrate as easily, and there's an interdependency of species of one upon another. And so there's the danger that you can have ecosystem collapse and lose a very large number of species. And we know from the Earth's history that that's not just a speculation. There have been times in the Earth's history when there was global warming of several degrees Celsius and a majority of the species on the planet went extinct. And, of course, others came into being, but over time periods of hundreds of thousands of years. So, for all practical purposes, we would be leaving a much more desolate planet for any time frame that humans can think about. So we really don't want to do that. We really cannot afford to have global warming of a few degrees. And yet that's the path that we are on if we follow business as usual and burn all these fossil fuels. And that conclusion has just not sunk in yet to the critical decision makers, and or for that matter, I think the public is just not yet aware of the full implications of using all of the fossil fuels. So, you know, climate forcing is an imposed perturbation on the planet's energy balance. So, for example, if the sun became 1% brighter, that would be a forcing of about 2 watts because the Earth absorbs 238 watts of energy from the sun. And that problem, that's a basic problem. We need to understand how sensitive the Earth's climate is to forcings. We're especially interested in the human-made forcing. And if we doubled the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the added carbon dioxide makes the atmosphere more opaque in the thermal infrared region, so that the region the spectral region that emits energy to space becomes more opaque. That means the radiation to space is going to emerge from a higher level in the atmosphere, and the temperature in the atmosphere falls off with height. That means if you make the atmosphere more opaque, you reduce the emission to space and temporarily make the planet out of energy balance, so it will have to warm up in order to restore balance. Well, doubled carbon dioxide is a forcing of about 4 watts per meter squared, so that's equivalent to a 2% change in the sun's irradiance. In the late 1970s, the National Academy of Science under Jule Charney looked at this problem, tried to estimate with climate models how sensitive the climate would be to doubling carbon dioxide. And they estimated that it would warm about 3 degrees Celsius with doubled CO2, but with an error bar which was extremely large. So we're very uncertain as to how valid that was. Well, now we have ways to estimate that much more accurately based on the history of the Earth. The temperature, this is a record of the temperature over the last 400,000 years. It's obtained from an ice core in Antarctica. You drill a core through the ice sheet. The Antarctica is built up by snowfall piling up year after year and compressing into ice. And from the isotopic composition of the H2O, we can tell the temperature at which the snowflake formed that is preserved in the ice. And we, for the last 11 to 12,000 years, we've been living in this nice, warm interglacial period called the Holocene. But if we go back 20,000 years ago, there was an ice sheet that covered Canada and came down into the United States, and the planet was about 5 degrees colder than it is now. And we know the mechanisms that caused the global temperature change. They have to be changes in the atmosphere or on the surface, because the brightness of the sun did not change in that time period. And in fact, we know the changes in the atmosphere because in this same ice core, we can sample bubbles of air that existed at all times, at each point in time during this 400,000-year period. And what we see is that there was more methane and more carbon dioxide during the warm periods and less during the ice ages. We also know the area that was covered by the ice sheets and how the reflectivity of the surface changed. So these two mechanisms, the changes on the surface and in the atmosphere, represented forcings of respectively 3.5 watts for the surface change and 3 watts for the greenhouse gas changes. That total forcing of 6.5 watts maintained a planet temperature change of about 5 degrees Celsius. So that implies a sensitivity of about 0.75 degrees for each watt of forcing. And we can now check that sensitivity for this entire 400,000-year period because we have records from which we can infer the sea level as a function of time over that same time period. And sea level, of course, changed. During the last ice age, sea level was more than 100 meters lower than it is now. Well, the water that is not in the ocean is on the ice sheets on the continents, and it tells us how big the ice sheets were, and therefore we can calculate the climate forcing due to the ice sheets for this entire period, and we have the greenhouse gas record for the same period. So if we just add up those two climate forcings and multiply by 0.75 degrees, we get a calculated temperature curve indicated by the blue curve, which agrees very well with the observed temperature, which is inferred from the isotopic composition of the ice cores. So it shows that this climate sensitivity, as an equilibrium sensitivity, is valid for this entire period. That analysis took the ice sheets area and the greenhouse gas changes as specified boundary conditions as if they were forcings. And of course now, as humans are putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, we are in effect specifying the amount of greenhouse gases. So it is, in this case, a forcing. But in this natural case, in these climate changes are actually associated with changes in the Earth's orbit, which initiates changes in the size of the ice sheet by melting ice, as one of the main parameters is the change in the tilt of the Earth's spin axis. So when that is tilted more, these changes are due to perturbations as Jupiter and Saturn tug on the Earth. They slightly change the Earth's orbit and the inclination of the spin axis. As the spin axis is tilted more, then you tend to melt ice at the poles. As the temperature changes, that in turn melts more ice, and it changes the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. As the ocean warms, the greenhouse gases will come out of the ocean. And so those are operating as feedbacks on these long time scales. If we want to understand the sensitivity of the system when the greenhouse gases are arbitrarily changed, we can in fact graph the greenhouse gas forcing over this 400,000 year time period and choose the vertical scale such that it matches the observed temperature change. And what we see is that the sensitivity is 1.5 degrees Celsius for each watt of forcing. In other words, it's twice as large as the sensitivity when we only include the fast feedback processes. So it tells us that if you allow the climate system long enough time for the ice sheets to begin to melt and for the forests to begin to move, then the climate sensitivity is even larger than the 3 degrees for doubled CO2. And what we're doing now, what we have done by burning fossil fuels is increase methane, so it's far outside the range that has existed for hundreds of thousands of years and even millions of years. And CO2, likewise, we have increased far outside the range that has existed. It takes the climate system time to respond because the ocean is 4 kilometers deep and it takes time for it to warm up. So far, we have seen a warming of less than 1 degree Celsius, but the equilibrium response to the net human-made climate forcing, if greenhouse gases were the only thing that we were doing to the planet, then we would expect a warming of several degrees Celsius. Now, actually, we're doing other things. We're putting aerosols, small particles, in the atmosphere, which have a cooling effect. But the net forcing is still large enough that if we wait long enough, we're going to have a warming of a few degrees Celsius. And this would be equivalent to the temperature in the Pliocene, when sea level was about 25 meters higher than it is now. There was no sea ice in the Arctic in the warm season. The implications of this Pleistocene climate change are that the climate system is very sensitive on long timescales, and human-made forcings now dwarf natural forcings. humans are now in control of the mechanisms for global climate change, for better or worse. And that's what we need to understand. If we were to burn all the fossil fuels and more than double the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, the equilibrium response would be a planet with no ice on it, the same way it was 50 million years ago when CO2 was about double what it is now. So I don't know if I've made it clear in this presentation, but the science is clear that we cannot burn all the fossil fuels without having dramatic consequences on timescales which we're going to be feeling over the next several decades. So our children and grandchildren are going to be inheriting a problem which is not of their making. So there's a big generational inequity here, which, as long as we didn't understand that we were causing a future problem, then perhaps we couldn't be blamed for it. But it has become clear that we are leaving an enormous and problem which is going to be extremely difficult. Once you put the CO2 up there, it's very hard to get it back. That's why I say we need, in a very short time period, to have a moratorium on coal-fired power plants and then to phase out coal. And in that way, we just have a shot at avoiding the most damaging consequences of climate change. And I know it's hard for people to understand that because you go outdoors and the weather seems fine. You say, oh, I don't see much going on. How can I believe that? Well, I think it's the science, if you look at it and look at the history of the Earth, you'll see how sensitive it is. And that's what we need to get people to understand. Thanks. The planetary, the small changes in the Earth's orbit are actually a very small direct forcing. The mechanisms by which that small forcing was magnified into these huge changes. The two mechanisms were changes in atmospheric composition, the greenhouse gases increased, and changes in the surface reflectivity due to ice and snow melting or growing. Both of those mechanisms are now completely under our control. Ice and snow are melting all over the planet, and greenhouse gases are increasing. So small changes, in fact, the trend of the Earth's orbital parameters now is in the direction that it would cause the planet to cool. But it's totally overwhelmed. You see, now the Earth is closest to the Sun in January. And that tends to make winters slightly warmer in the Northern Hemisphere and summers cooler. And that's what you need in order to begin to build an ice sheet in the Northern Hemisphere. But that cannot happen now. So another ice age cannot happen as long as humans are on the planet, because a thimbleful of chlorofluorocarbons is enough to overcome that natural tendency. In the natural case, because it was feedbacks which then amplify over time, but now the human forcing is so much larger and of a positive sign, which means a warming sign, that the natural tendency toward cooling is just totally overwhelmed. We are now completely in control. There are a couple of places where CO2 is being sequestered now. It's being injected into oil wells where it enhanced for the purpose of enhancing oil recovery from the wells. But it does show that you can inject it beneath geological formations where it is stable. There are always some issue about whether some of it will leak out on the 1,000-year timescale. But if you, it has been suggested that if you would inject it beneath ocean sediments at a depth where it's inherently stable, then you don't have to worry about it leaking out. So technically, it's probably possible to do that and not have to worry too much about it leaking out. But it's going to add to the cost. My guess is that if we would stop subsidizing fossil fuels, and, you know, I mean, this what happened this last summer is really crazy, where the Congress did not renew the renewable energy credits, but it did allow the subsidies for fossil fuels to continue. If we would once get moving in the right direction, I think we would end up deciding that there were better sources of energy, and we would end up leaving most of the coal in the ground rather than capturing the CO2 and sequestering it. Just as one example, the solar thermal energy, there's now a power plant being built in Nevada which will transmit electrical energy to California for solar thermal power, which is beginning to be of a size that's significant. And that you could, on a small fraction of the Southwest desert, you could produce electricity for the United States. You would need to have a grid, a low-loss electrical grid, but the technology for that exists. It would require setting up that infrastructure. But I doubt that carbon capture and sequestration is really the long-term solution, but it could be in the mix. Let it compete with the others and see what is most effective and most least costly. The question relates particularly to China and India and the places where populations are growing and they're building a lot of coal-fired power plants. We first have to get our own house in order, because if you look at the amount of excess CO2 in the atmosphere today, China has just passed us in current emissions just in the past year. But for the CO2 that's up there, we're responsible for more than three times more than they are, even though their population is much larger than ours. So on a per capita basis, we're more than 10 times more responsible than they are. So we really have a responsibility, and it actually makes sense for us to solve our problem and develop technologies which we can sell to them so we can get some of our money back. But in many ways, the Chinese government is recognizing this more forcefully than we are. They have contracted with British companies to build 5 carbon-free cities. It'll take decades to do that. They will tend to suffer more from the climate change than we will, or at least as much. So I think that it will be possible to get them to come along, but we've not been doing our part. It is true that personal vehicles, people will never want to give up personal vehicles, but they're, you know, we're going to have to, the oil is about half used already. So we're going to have to find something beyond that. It may be electric cars, or it may be hydrogen, which then you have to make the hydrogen with something there. But you could do it in where the renewables are very abundant, and even though they're intermittent, you can use them, for example, to make hydrogen. But so we will have to find ways that provide energy without producing CO2. We have no choice, and it will have to apply to other countries as well as ours. But it would be to our advantage to get going on it now. The question is about sea level, because IPCC and their number, they gave a number for sea level rise this century, which was only a fraction of a meter. a foot and a half or something like that. But their sea level rise included only thermal expansion and mountain glacier contributions. They did not include contributions of ice sheet melting because they didn't know how big it is. But that, of course, is a case of looking under the streetlight for your loss, because that's, you can give good numbers for those processes, but those are not the big issue. The question is, how much sea level rise will you get from the ice sheets? And it's a very hard problem. But if we look at paleoclimate, we can see that the eventual sea level rise associated with the temperature change of a few degrees is huge. It's many meters. It's a question of how long it takes. But again, if we look at paleoclimate, there are cases where sea level went up 5 meters in 100 years, which is a meter every 20 years. So ice sheets can melt fast, and now it's recognized that the processes that occur in ice sheet disintegration are not included in any of the models. So, and if we just look at what's happening now on Greenland, and even West Antarctica is losing ice at a rate of more than 100 cubic kilometers per year. So things are beginning to happen there, which make glaciologists and relevant experts very worried privately. You don't understand it well enough to give numbers, and nobody wants to do that. But boy, if you look at the Earth's history, it makes you think ice sheets can disintegrate quite rapidly. Yeah, those he's asking about clean coal and nuclear. The truth is, at this time, there is no such thing as clean coal. We still haven't figured out a way to catch the mercury. The best can now reduce it by 2/3, but we're still, mercury is a big problem, and that's why you're told not to eat too many certain fish, because mercury is beginning to accumulate in the environment, and if we just keep building more and more power plants, it's going to get worse and worse. So, but clean coal, yeah, so that's different. You know, the administration says clean coal, but they don't include capturing carbon dioxide. So if you're not capturing the CO2, then it's not really clean coal, and even the other pollutants, it's very difficult to capture all of them. Nuclear is a difficult subject. Nuclear is, I would much rather live by a nuclear power plant than by a coal-fired power plant, and I would not be so concerned, but many people have concerns about nuclear power. I think the problem which caused the U.S. to stop making them, the danger of an accident, that can be solved, especially with the newer technologies on that. But one problem that hasn't been solved is the cost. Nuclear is very expensive. And it also, there's the danger of proliferation of weapons. So it was not on the top of my list, it would be, but it's better than, if it's a choice between that and coal, then I would certainly would prefer nuclear. But we're not doing half of what we should with energy efficiency. We could, you know, our utilities make more money if they sell you more energy. And so the places where, there are a couple of states which have tried to change those rules, and at least partially successful, and California is one of them. And its use of energy per unit GNP is much better, actually a factor of 2 better than most other states. So there are things like that that should be exploited first, I think. And I think that renewable energies have much more potential if we would just encourage them in the way that we have encouraged fossil fuels.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.